Hello, everybody, and welcome to Story Nerds in 2020. My name is Jessica Kate, and what you are about to hear is a special first episode. It's a little different to what we normally do. This is the audio from the Facebook Live launch party that we held this week for my new romantic comedy, A Girl's Guide to the Outback. So I'm super excited that Sam and Kimberly's story is out there now. And we had heaps of fun with our special guest, Bethany Turner, helping to launch the party. What you'll hear at the start is us laughing because we had 45 minutes of tech problems before we were able to actually get the party going. But we got there in the end and we had some great fun talking about behind the scenes stuff on the book, romantic comedies, and all sorts of fun stuff. So without any further ado, here is the launch party for A Girl's Guide to the Outback.
We're finally here! Thank you, people, for the 40 minutes of technical difficulties we just had, for hanging in there. We know that you really wanted to hear about this book, and now you will. Yay.
Yay.
So we're here with our lovely Hannah Davis, who has been helping us so much with the tech and will be working in the background. Due to the way Skype works, we will get a beautiful view of her working on the tech.
I'm going to set this space silence and stay out of everything, but you'll
thank
see
you
me
so
up here
much,
in the corner.
Thank you for saving us with technology. None of my live parties would happen if Hannah wasn't in the background running tech and that Angela wasn't in the background managing the comments and stuff for me and making sure they get through. Hopefully she knows to shoot them through now to the Skype chat or to me on Facebook Messenger, actually, because she's not in the chat. So if you want to message Hannah and ask her to shoot them to me on Facebook Messenger, hopefully I'll see them on there. And look, we're just going to roll. So welcome, folks, to A Girl's Guide to the Outback. Guys, the Girl's Guide to the Outback Facebook Live launch party. As you can see, we're Aussie themed because in Australia it was Australia Day 2 days ago, so there's a lot of Australia stuff I can buy really cheap. dropped my mouth. That's okay, we're rolling with it. And we're super excited about the book, and we're super excited to be here with Bethany Turner, who just did a champion job solo hosting our joint party for 15 minutes. You're a champ, Bethany, and you're feeling sick, so you're a legend. I think this gets you honorary Australian status, really.
That's all I was going for. Thank you. Worth it.
So, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, everybody, for coming to hear a bit about the book and about Australia and all that jazz. So if you missed Bethany reading it out on our previous attempt at going live, let me read to you the back cover copy of A Girl's Guide to the Outback. Now, have you noticed that my copy looks a little different? This is actually an ARC. My copies are still en route. I think they're somewhere over the Pacific right now. But hopefully I'll have a real one soon. Bethany has a real one.
I have a real one.
Some of the words may be slightly different in this one because we tweaked it. But here is, finally, the back cover copy for A Girl's Guide to the Outback. So, how far will a girl go to win back a guy she can't stand? Let me pause for a second. I'm pretty sure someone at my... I don't think I came up with that line. I think the publishing house did that, but they summed up my plot, like, better than how I could. I love that line. Thank you to whoever in marketing thought up that line, because that's completely what this whole book's about. Just to win back a guy, and they don't even like each other at the moment. So, let's see. This funny, sweet, and romantic story proves that opposites do attract and that God has a sense of humor. Samuel Payton is a passionate youth pastor in Virginia, but below the surface, he's still recovering from the blow of a failed business and insecurities he can't shake. His co-worker, startup expert Kimberly Foster, is brilliant, fearless, and capable, but years of personal rejection have left her defensive and longing for a family. Two people have never been more at odds or more attracted to one another, and every day at work, the sparks sure do fly. When Kimberly's ambitious plans for Sam's ministry butt up against his risk-averse nature, Sam decides that obligations to family trump his work. He quits the ministry and heads home to Australia to help his sister Jules save her struggling farm. But as Kimberly's grand plans flounder, she is forced to face the truth. No one can replace Sam. Together they strike up a deal. If Kimberly comes to work on Jules' dairy farm and lends her business brains to their endeavor, then maybe, just maybe, Sam will reconsider his future with the church. As Kimberly tries her hand at Australian farm life, she learns more about herself than she could have ever expected. Meanwhile, Sam is forced to reevaluate this spunky woman he thought he already knew. As foes slowly morph into friends, they wonder if they might be something even more. But when disaster looms, will Sam find it within himself to take a risk that could lead to love? And will Kimberly trust God with her future? Woo! So, Bethany, you were kind enough to endorse a girl's guide for me. Thank you so much for that.
I was honored to. I really was. I was saying before when I took everything hostage, that, you know, it was, I was happy to do it because I love you and you're the sweetest. And it's like, sure. Obviously I'll do it. I honestly didn't expect to get as caught up in the story as I did and to love it as much as I did. I really genuinely loved the story. I told you right away that Samuel Payton is my new book boyfriend. I know Janine was throwing in some Sam love as well. I really thoroughly enjoyed it and was thrilled to have the honor to endorse it for sure.
Thank you so much. So let's chat a little bit about the book. How do we want to chat about this? What did you think of it? What were some of the things that you found interesting that hooked you in?
Well, I mean, let's start with Samuel Payton. Hello.
It's a good place to start.
Why would we start anywhere else? First of all, Samuel Payton and Kimberly Foster, we met both of them in Love and Other Mistakes. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of curious, did you know from the beginning that they were going to have their own story?
I'm so glad you asked me that. I did not. So I wrote probably like 2 drafts of Love and Other Mistakes, at least 2 of them, before I ever started thinking about another book. When I started tossing around ideas for another book, I kind of realized, I was like, oh my gosh, Sam and Kimberly, who their roles in it were originally a little bit smaller. And I thought, they already had an undercurrent. So always through the story, Kimberly and Natalie competed for the same job, and Sam was always going to choose Natalie, but she ends up learning that that's not her place and that she's better meant for something else, and she turns the job down, and so it goes to Kimberly. So I was like, Sam wasn't going to choose Kimberly, and Kimberly always had a bit of a rough edge to her because she was a foil to Natalie and sort of made Natalie's life harder. So she always had a little bit of an edge there, right. And I thought, those two don't really like each other. They're set up as colleagues already in this book. What a great people that I could have not like each other and then have a circumstance where they are forced in close proximity for a long time. So, so then I was able to go back. I rewrote Love and Other Mistakes. You know, there were so many drafts to that book. So drafts 4, 5, and 6 probably. I strengthened the Sam and Kimberly aspects each time. And it was so fun to get to go back and layer in little hints, because I wrote A Girl's Guide to the Outback and Love and Other Mistakes still wasn't out. So then I went back with my new knowledge of the two characters and I could layer stuff in with a completed draft to refer to. So that was really cool, getting to kind of try and put little bits in to get people a bit interested. And I ended up putting in, I think, the scene with Natalie and Sam in the cafe and where they break up. And then Kimberly shows up and has a conversation with Natalie. That scene was added in really late in Love and Other Mistakes. It was one of my very last edits. And I was able to put a few little details in Kimberly there that I felt kind of gave a little hint as to the direction they would go and gave a little bit more likability to her and insight into her character. And that was really fun. I never would have gotten to do that if I hadn't been able to work on both books at the same time. So
Love that. Okay. See, I had no idea when I asked that question what the answer was. And that's so interesting. And because when I read, I did read Love and Other Mistakes. And you know, I think Kim in particular for me, she was noteworthy and she was interesting and all that. But you did such a good job of almost, I mean, you don't want me thinking about her too much in that book because it's Natalie's book. I mean, so it's as it should be as far as my view on her. And yet, yes, when I started this, I felt like I knew these characters just enough. And yet, what I loved almost from the get-go was I felt like I knew who they were, but I also realized pretty immediately, there's so much more to these characters than I thought I knew. And I think especially with Sam, I loved that because he's a, you know, to look at him, and not just to look at him, although that, but to look at him as a character, you know, he seems like he pretty much has it all together. He's got this, he's this passionate, engaging leader, speaker, all of these things. He's leading this ministry and all these things. And yet you were able to create him as someone who is very layered. And I think in a lot of ways, as I read it, you know, it's like he's really his worst enemy in a lot of ways. And I loved that, you know, and some of the challenges that you gave him with his family, which is the story overall, but then the character of, you know, of him having some things that really affect his confidence. What, talk a little bit about that, if you would. Like, what made you want to create this guy who's seemingly, you know, all that, and yet in his mind, he's very lacking.
Good question. I'm trying to remember how far back in my planning process. I think I must have worked out early on something about him having a failed business. It was always a cafe was always linked to it. And I ended up adding in a few other layers of his dyslexia, which ties into a question that Angela's sending me through here. So I'll dive more into that in a second. She's asking about Sam's dyslexia. So I kind of laid in that, but then also his experience with his father and how his, at a point in the book, you realize that his father had sort of maybe sort of started this pattern of attempting things and not being able to pull it off and kind of letting down the family. And so he's kind of felt there's about three different points where he's been sort of reinforced that if you fly too high, then you get burned. And I think that came from Kimberly was always a fairly ambitious kind of character. And so I just kind of thought, well, if she is such a gun at what she's doing, then Sam just needs to have sort of the opposite issue for them to drive each other nuts. And it kind of flowed out of that. Because I think because Kimberly had to be such a challenge to Natalie, I sort of made Kimberly this little, what do you call them, wunderkind. Like she was a real young but smart and driven and really good. And so with her set up like that, I always kind of felt like I always wanted them to be their own worst enemies and their flaws to be their own insecurities playing off each other in the worst way. So that kind of led me down the path of thinking up different ways that I could get Sam to feel insecure and not believe in himself.
Yeah. Which another aspect of that I love, you know, you did mention the dyslexia and I'd love to talk more about that because that was something I genuinely loved about this character. But it also was something that made me genuinely love Kim more because of her response to that. So yeah, talk about that a little more if you would.
Oh, sure. So where had I even had the idea for that? So I do not personally have dyslexia, nor does anyone in my family, but I turned to research with a lot of people that I reached out to online and friends and friends of friends. So I talked with a lot of people who have experienced dyslexia or their children had dyslexia and things like that. Got a lot of them to read the entire book and give their feedback and change things as a result of that. So big shout out to all the people who helped me out with that. I appreciate it so much to make Sam's journey with that authentic. I just wanted to make him a little more, there's probably a couple of reasons, make him a little more relatable, first of all, because I like the theme of people, they often look like they have it all together, but they're struggling underneath. And his character especially was set up in Love and Other Mistakes as a foil to Jem. So Sam was better looking, Sam was more successful, Sam had so much going for him. And in general, as you probably notice in my books, a lot of romance stuff is really shiny and bright and like hyper reality, you know, more glamorous than real life. And I like to just take a little bit of the shine off that, just a little bit, and make them a little bit more real. And so in Love and Other Mistakes, Ollie had diabetes, which was because a friend of mine has diabetes and got it young as a child. And so things like that I felt helped just ground the story a little more and kind of show people this is happening in not the real world, but, you know, more of a real world, like people – our heroes and heroines can have some of these challenges that a lot of us have in everyday life and stuff like that. And so dyslexia just kind of came into mind as something that I could give to Sam that would just make him a little more realistic, and maybe some people would be able to relate to him with that. And as I looked into it a little bit more, it was interesting, you know, having conversations with people I knew, and when I told them that I was working on it, they said, oh, I have dyslexia, let me tell you about it. I never knew that that they did. And then I got this whole new insight into people that I knew, and that was cool. And a few people said, oh, I really enjoy it. I don't read about characters who are dyslexic. I enjoy reading about someone who has that. So that was really fun, just getting to sort of expand that world a little bit. So I'm kind of thinking about what I can do in there.
Yeah.
Des, I want to pop in and ask one really quick follow-up question to that. What was something or maybe one or two things about dyslexia that you learned via your research and
was incorporated? So much stuff. So I'd had a friend when I was a teenager who had dyslexia, and she had colored glasses, and you often see things on different websites that let you change the background color. And when I talked to a lot of people with dyslexia, they said, that's crap, that doesn't fix it. And it seems to be an area of controversy. They were like, don't even mention it, it's super controversial. And so I found that really interesting. Obviously my friend chose to wear the glasses. She felt she was getting some kind of benefit, but a lot of people I chatted to were like, nope, it's a misconception, it doesn't help me at all, da-di-da. So it presents in so many different ways as well. It's not just as simple as letters getting jumbled up. There's all sorts of different ways it can manifest, and what's actually happening in the brain I learned about, and different strategies people have for coping with it and being able to get their jobs done and their day jobs, which involve reading computer screens all day and all that, all the different ways they can do it, the technology that's out there to assist now, and yet the technology gaps that are still out there. It was interesting. And then about a whole range of other similar things that perhaps people in the past thought were dyslexia or that were misclassified, but it's just one on a whole spectrum of sort of similar-ish conditions. And there's a whole bunch of them. You know, I think there's like an audio version as well where when people are speaking, the words can get jumbled up. I can't remember the specifics now, but I remember saying, oh, it's not just eyes, it's other things. And I probably said it all wrong, but yeah, there's a whole bunch of things that I didn't even know were there. And the school system actually was one of the most surprising things. When I said to people, you know, I reached out to some, there's some support groups on Facebook for parents of dyslexic children in Australian school systems. And I said, hey, here's my character, here's his age. He would have gone to primary school in the 90s, high school in the noughties, in rural Australia. What kind of support would he have had at school? Thinking they would say, oh, a teacher aid, some kind of help with his tests or something like that. And their answers were none. He wouldn't have gotten anything. They wouldn't have even diagnosed it a lot of the time. And I was like, what? Like, Sam is the same age, let me point out, almost the same. I think he's a year or two older, but he's almost the same age as me. And so I'm picturing my childhood growing up in rural Australia and going to those schools. I did not realize there was so little support out there and that things are really only just starting to get investigated and supported and more research into them. And that really surprised me.
Oh, wow. Yeah, well, you did a great job of making that, all of that, not just the dyslexia part of who he is, but the what his experience would have been like growing up, making that part of who he is. And like I said, it just made me love Kim even more, too, just because of her heart for it all, but also her get it done about it all in the same way of like, you're going to let that stop you? You know, I loved that about her. And so that was, I think I would be greatly amiss if at this point we didn't say, you know, there are really three lead characters of this book, in my opinion. You've got Sam, you've got Kim, and you've got Australia. Is that safe to say?
That probably is safe to say.
So certainly for those of us who aren't in Australia, you know, for you, it's just, this is life. But it was so fascinating to read all of this, and it felt so real. I don't even know where to begin on this topic, but I do know it you've said that it's a lot of based on real life as far as upbringing kind of things. So yeah, tell us about that.
So I'm not that you can really see. I'll flip my computer around so you get a quick look. I'm sitting on my parents' farm at the moment. That's the lookout to there. Now Green Garden, because we finally got a tiny bit of rain. The drought is not broken, but it has eased very slightly. So yes. We have a green tinge. My dad is a dairy farmer, or has been for a lot of my growing up years, done all different kinds of farming as well. And so, yeah, it was cool for me to get to share different parts of my childhood through the book. And Yarra Plains, which is the Peyton family farm that they're trying to save, that is largely based on a property that I lived on for a year when I was 13 up in rural Queensland. And that was actually a very tough year. That farm wasn't, you know, unlike the Peytons, who were trying to save a farm that's been in their family for generations. That one was not one that we'd been on for generations, and we actually didn't even want to be living there. It was drought and different circumstances. It kind of meant that we were stuck there for a little while until we could get it sold. And that little while ended up getting longer and longer and longer and longer and longer in the middle of a drought. And that was a tough year, especially as a 13, 14-year-old. We were homeschooled during that year. We couldn't go into the church and different things. We were very isolated. And so getting to take a year of memories that weren't great, but then there were also some really cool things that happened that year. You know, my brother and sister, I'm now the oldest of five, but at the time I was the oldest of three, and my brother and sister and I made a ton of good memories on that farm too. And now as an adult, I look back and I only remember the good stuff, really. Like, yeah. In the book, there's a description of a zip line, or a flying fox, we call it, over the river. And I tweaked the design of it slightly, but we really did have a flying fox over the river. One of our friends fell off it and hit the bank. It was a bit severe. but that was great fun. And different things that we did on the farm. There's one time where Kimberly goes and hides in a big pile of cottonseed, and it's big and spongy, and she like carves out a little seat and sits there and watches the sunset. We used to get 20-ton truckloads of cottonseed and jump in it and throw it around and play with it as kids, and they're all spongy and soft and squishy, and it's really fun when you're a kid to burrow tunnels in it and stuff. So getting to share the good memories and to put in different memories from other, you know, once we finally got to leave that place, we moved down closer to family, to other properties where we had a great time. We were near lots of family. We made lots of good friends. And that's sort of where the sense of belonging that Jules has that's attached to Yarra Plains, that comes from the other locations where we got to be with a lot of uncles and aunties and grandparents and cousins and good friends. And that was a really special thing. So getting to kind of funnel all that concentrated emotion into just one patch of land really helped me form the emotions that they had attached to it. And then Kimberly, you know, when I imagine my life, I'm someone who really values family and belonging and all that. If I imagine a life not having that, that's just what Kimberly was. Me, if I didn't get all that good stuff. And she was really desperate for it. So that was really cool. And it's not often that there are a lot of, in the Australian romance market, there are a lot of romance books set on properties, but they're not written for an American audience. And I've always read a lot of American Christian romance books. And so to get to share my patch of Australia with that audience, you know, the Aussie books are written for other Aussies. They already understand the terminology. They're already familiar with the concepts. But to get to write one where I was kind of sharing it with people who didn't know a lot about it apart from watching The Crocodile Hunter and Crocodile Dundee, that was really fun.
I think you did such a good job too of that perspective of Kim coming in for the first time. And I mean, I've never been to Australia, unfortunately. But it's like, I felt her sense of wonder that I'm sure we would have as Americans of the stark differences, but also the similarities and times and all of the different things she was able to relate to. But then the way she fell in love with it, you know, which was so much, as I saw it, it was like, it had about this much to do with Australia and about this much to do with family and you know, all of that. But just watching her experience that was fun as an American, you know, but also seeing Sam get to just show her his world a little bit. So I loved that.
Good. I'm so glad. And Andrew's asked me here, she's passed on some questions. What's some of my favorite Aussie things I included in the book? Good question. Fun stuff. Something that was real. You will see in the book pretty early on, there is a charming vet who lives next, well, he doesn't live next door. He lives at the Gold Coast, which is a long way away, but his parents live next door and he's very short term back to help them for a little bit. And he has some history with Sam's sister Jules, and they have a big slip and slide that's made out of silage plastic, and they've stacked up dairy buckets at the end of it. So when you slide down the silage plastic, you are a human 10-pin bowling ball and you've got to try and knock all the dairy buckets over. That is a real thing that me and my youth group kids used to do at my grandparents' lawn. It was really fun. When we get sick of sliding like penguins, we'd sit an esky, which is an Australian word. I think Americans call it a cooler. It's a big insulated box that keeps your drinks cold. We would like sit that at the front of the plastic, and so you had to jump over that and then land on the plastic and slide, or you had to knock buckets over, all different things. So it was fun putting some of the old youth group games in there. and of course I put in some, I mentioned some koalas and some kangaroos, although the first kangaroo you will notice that is in there, and for a while the only kangaroo, is the dead one that she sees. Sam points out, oh, there's a kangaroo, and it's like a lump of roadkill, and she's like, oh. And when I turned in the manuscript, my editor wrote back and said, do you realize you only have dead kangaroo in this whole book? Can you give me some live kangaroos? So then I went back through and like put in all these times when they saw live kangaroos. And other
thank
stuff.
You for that. Thanks to your editor.
But that was fun because a lot of the time kangaroos are dead on the side of the road. Hannah and I have talked about it a lot. They're like our we do have a little bit of deer here, but not much. And in America, you know, there's deer hit on the side of the road, but we think they're super cute. We're like, oh, what deer? Bambi, blah, blah, blah. For us kangaroos, it's like, ugh, hit it with the blah, blah.
Which it's just like, we can't identify with that at all as Americans. We're just like, but it's a kangaroo. What are you talking about?
I have a big dent in my car from stupid kangaroos.
Oh, so man.
I put Vegemite in there, and I think I may have even described a little bit like proper Vegemite application technique, hot toast, buttered, and then a thin layer of Vegemite, people. The reason you don't like Vegemite is because you put it on too thick, and then, yeah, that's not good, but yeah. Hugh Jackman demonstrated it on Jimmy Fallon once, so if you YouTube it, you get a good Vegemite demonstration with Hugh Jackman.
Hugh did it right, huh?
So, he did it right.
Okay.
And we got backyard cricket in there, so cricket, you know, British game, Australians are very into it. I'm not wildly into it. Australian boys are more into it, but some girls. But backyard cricket's fun, and so it was fun to put the rules of it in there, and just sort of the intense way that Australians get serious about their sport, and the trash talk. Jules and Mick are trash talking each other, and that was fun to put in, so those kind of vibes. And yeah, those are a few fun Aussie things to include.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Mick and Jules. Are they getting their own story?
Well, I mean, I don't know how much I should say about this to not spoil what happens in A Girl's Guide to the Outback. I should say I have no plans at the moment.
Okay.
Because I'm happy where they're at, but I'm planning cameos. So,
gotcha.
Nothing's definite because I'm still submitting my proposal for a third book to my publisher. So we have no idea at the moment what that will actually turn out as. I'm just spitting some ideas out at the moment. But I have an idea of how you may see them again. So
great.
That's fun to think about.
That's good. Because they were a lot of fun, but they were more than fun. I mean, there was so much depth in their story as well. Really a surprising amount. A pleasantly surprising amount for a supporting role. And they could definitely carry their own story, but I see what you're saying. I'll trust you on that. We'll see where we end up there.
I'm glad you brought them up because Mick is my favorite character in the book.
Really?
I love Mick. I love that he grew up in the country and he's completely comfortable there, but he loves the coast and he loves the surf, and he often wears super daggy clothes, which daggy's probably an Australian word. What would the equivalent of daggy be? not dressy clothes, and they'll be sort of half country but then half surfer culture, which are very different cultures. There's not a lot of crossover in that in Australia. You're either a surfer or your country. But he combines them, and he has no embarrassment over what he's wearing. He shows up in a couple scenes wearing his mum's rainbow Crocs, and he doesn't care because they're comfortable.
Yeah.
And I just really like that.
Yeah, he very much is comfortable in his own skin. That was for sure.
He is. And their story was a surprise to me. I did not plan them. So Sam and Kim, I had a slight plan of what I wanted to do with them. I had no plans at all for Jules apart from being Sam's sister. And then I wrote a scene where a vet was needed. I won't say too much about why, but anyway, a vet had to appear onto the farm. And this was, I think I was writing chapter 6, I'd been stuck and I had nothing to write. So I was like, I'm just going to make this thing happen and have fun with it and see where it goes. And so then they had to get the vet out to the farm, and he gets out of the ute and he nods at Jules and says, Julia. And she says, Michael, in like a sort of a standoffish tone. And he just walks off and deals with the animals. And I didn't plan any of that. It just came out of my fingers. And then I was like, ooh, this is interesting. And totally winged it for their story. And I did. It meant I had to edit it heavily because winging it never turns out anything good the first time. But it was fun to just explore that. And it ended up being this kind of gender-swapped kind of alternate history of my parents, because my mum is from the beach and my dad is from the country, and they did marry at 20 and have spent 30 years compromising on where they live. And so Mick and Jules ended up being a bit of a, what if they had have walked away at 20 and gone their separate ways to the places that they would have lived individually, but then 10 years later, what would have happened there? So yeah, that was just kind of a concept that I don't even know that I thought about while I wrote it, but when I looked at it and looked back, I was like, oh, they just kind of came out of the way. So it's not like I was thinking about my parents while I read it. Ew. But yeah, when I looked back, I was like, oh, there's a pattern there. That's cool.
Well, I saw we got a question from Rachel, which I think that's a great time while we're talking about what's coming next and all of that. She's saying she wants a full length based on the people from The Kiss Thief, which, if people don't know what The Kiss Thief is, go ahead and tell us a little about The Kiss Thief right now too.
So I've started a little tradition, which Hannah's fanning herself.
So good, you guys, so good. Just ask Jess about my comments.
I sent her the draft of The Kiss Thief, and it came back with all these, like, hubba-hubba comments all through it, which cracked me up. They're still in my Instagram feed if you go back and look at it. I've started a bit of a tradition to celebrate the launch of each novel. I write a short story, so the people who aren't familiar with my writing can have a look at the short story, see if they like it. And my goal with these short stories is to pack all the cuteness, all the kisses, all the romantic tropes and moments and stuff from pretty much a novel's worth down into like 1 to 3 chapters and give you like this condensed shot in the arm of rom-com juice. And so this was my second one. So I did The Kiss Dare first, and then this one was The Kiss Thief. And yeah, so it's out with my newsletter. If people subscribe to my newsletter, they get a copy of it. And it's got the link to the Girls Guide to the Outback in the back of it. And yeah, so I wrote it because I was thinking about New Girl. I love the show New Girl. And there's an episode called Pepperwood where Nick and Jess are trying to break your head. Bethany knows what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Nick and Jess are trying to break into someone's backyard because of some not well-founded suspicions that they have that this person's a bad person and stuff. And there's different moments where they nearly get caught, and there's a moment where the person comes back and they hide against the brick wall. But they – and I always thought that was a cute moment that the show could have expanded on more. And this is like – this is in season 2 where they're really working towards getting Nick and Jess together too, who, by the way, are my all-time favorite TV couple. I love New Girl so much. And so I was like, what if I wrote a short story that was just that? They're trying to break into someone's backyard or house or something, and they almost get caught, but we take that moment where they almost get caught and we push it further, like Captain America. This is the other half of the inspiration, Captain America 2. The one with Black Widow when they're trying to hide from the bad guys, and she's like, public displays of affection make people uncomfortable. And he's like, yes, they do. That scene always cracked me up. I love that whole movie. It's one of my favorite Marvel movies. And so I kind of like mashed the two ideas together and came out with Louisiana chef Donnie Grayson and Australian handy woman Jack Piper, or Jacqueline Piper, and their little adventure because Jack's scumbag ex-boyfriend has stolen like her most precious memento of her dead mother, which is this cookbook which her mother had put together, handwritten, and a scummy ex-boyfriend has it. And so she and Donnie, well, she's going to go and get it back. Donnie just thinks she's going to go ask for it back. He doesn't realize that she's planning on breaking and entering. But then the escapades start from there.
Wow.
So I'm so glad that Rachel really liked it. I don't know. I'd have to ponder. The structure of a short story is different to the structure of a novel because you have to have a problem. It's, well, they're the same structure, but you just got to shrink it. So it's got to be a problem that can be solved like in a night. So I would have to, I'm not sure how I would turn that into a novel, but we'll put it in the memory bank. We'll see what pops out.
Oh.
Well, but it's why I keep different lists of different problems. I have like novel-sized problems that could inspire a whole book, and then I have short story-sized problems where people can like, yeah, get together quick.
So, again, to repeat, people can get that for free, right?
For free!
If they are subscribers to your newsletter, which how do they subscribe to your newsletter? Do they need to go to your website?
If you go to my website, then there is a subscribe link. You scroll to the bottom of the page and there's a thing there and it says, and there's also a pop-up that pops up when you go to the website as well. And put your email address in there. Boom shakalaka. You get a little mini rom-com and it's awesome.
Okay. Well, you sold it. So I haven't had a chance to read that one yet, but I can't wait. I look forward to it, especially after knowing all the Nick and Jess inspiration is in there. So that's, which I think that's a great segue into talking a little bit about, you know, there are elements of movies that you love that you incorporate in books and TV, obviously. And so, yeah, I know in this one, you said that obviously like, enemies to lovers is a big part of this. What specific movies or storylines or whatever, different tropes did you really want to bring to A Girl's Guide to the Outback?
Oh, well, it was fully enemies to lovers from the start, was always some kind of spin on that. But then all my books are. So there's always either enemies to lovers or opposites attract. It's somewhere on that spectrum is always where it pops out because it's just, I just never get sick of it, man. Like, I just want more and more of those stories. And if people aren't going to write them fast enough for me to read, then I'm just going to write them myself. So that's where we're at. But I made a little list here of different, like, oh, I'm just trying to, like, turn down my phone so I don't get cross echoes between my computer and my phone. Sorry, folks. I'm trying to be able to see your comments at the same time as I'm talking. Here we go. Rom-coms that either are linked or like indirectly influenced or just looking back, I'm like, oh, these are totally, if you like this, then you like that. The Proposal. What can you say?
Yeah.
It's so good.
It says it all.
I love it. Sorry. Yeah. I love it. Denise Hunter's The Accidental Bride has like a little thing in it that it linked. I think I read it around the time when I was writing A Girl's Guide to the Outback, or in the year or two previous to it. And it was a story I had a lot of fun reading. And it was one that was sort of in the back of my mind as I wrote A Girl's Guide to the Outback, because while I had tons of fun with Denise's book, I wanted to do a version of that kind of story. Not that hers is also a, like, accident, people accidentally got married, obviously, an accidental bride. But it happens, like, they hate each other, and it's all set on this horse ranch in America. And I was like, oh, cool book. Awesome job, Denise. But I wanted to see the Jess version of that that had an Australian farm and dairy cows instead of horses and, you know, a real commercial operation. My dad is a farmer, so I absorbed a pretty sadly small amount of farm knowledge from having lived on them for so long. I would just trot my manuscript over to Dad and say, Dad, what would break the feeder wagon? And what would they do to fix it? And all that kind of stuff. And so that version, and also a version where the, I think the farm in The Accidental Bride is in a certain amount of peril, but I really wanted to push the envelope on that because I've grown up in, I think I've spent almost as much of my life in drought as out of it probably. And while our family has been quite fortunate through a lot of those circumstances, a lot of other ones haven't. And living in a rural area, I think Australian farms are probably, there would certainly be American farms that are very isolated, but Australia, while we're a similar-ish, we're a little smaller than the US, but we only got 25 million people. So you can imagine the elbow room that we have.
Yeah.
We have big distances, and I just wanted to show some of my experience through a similar story, but it just showed, you know, some other things. There's a lot of stories about horse ranches and other things like that, and I wanted to, like, take the awesomeness and just give it a little different twist. So that was a cool one to have in my head. It was really good fun, and thank you, Denise, for helping me out there with all those good ideas. 2 weeks' notice. That's a fun love-hate co-workers, office workers thing.
It's one of my favorites of all time.
It's good stuff. Set it up. Didn't come out until after I had done a couple of drafts of A Girl's Guide, but watching it was awesome. And also, it's helping me with, like, future books because I was chatting with our friend Melissa Ferguson about the structure of rom-coms and her book that will be coming out late this year, and Girl's Guide to the Outback, and Set It Up was the movie example we were using to talk about, and we were kind of working out some elements to the structure of rom-coms, and that was super fun, and that one helped. New Girl, obviously. Castle, Bones, any of those TV shows that were and romances, and they weren't enemies to lovers, but they were opposites attract. Bones, yeah. Castle, big examples of opposites attract. Slow Burn, co-workers, they had history. I was addicted to those shows as like a 14, 15-year-old, 20-year-old, 25-year-old, 28-year-old. So they were definitely things that I wanted to replicate. And I totally, like, Sam and Kimberly had worked together for 3 years. They worked in the same office, but they were total opposites. They were fighting a lot. So I got to inject all that history that normally you have to get 3 seasons of a TV show to watch. I just injected it into their backstory and got to show some of it in Love and Other Mistakes. So that was super fun.
Yeah. And I loved, I mean, talking about the backstory, it's like there is this, we can make the assumptions of what the time between the two books were like. I mean, we can make that assumption, but it's like from the moment we pick up and we're running. And I would actually love to see more little short stories of that in between time if you ever feel like it, while we're just putting in requests of what you should write.
That's a good thought.
Because the romantic, well, the attraction / tension was very, it was already there. It was already, there from the time we start this. So
from
when
the
were the first moments?
In wearing that Captain America costume.
Yep. Yep. Exactly. So it's like, what did we miss? I mean, we get it. We're not missing anything story-wise, but there would be some lovely moments if you ever wanted to share them with us, I'm sure. So.
That's a great idea.
So, and you're welcome, everyone.
That's it. Thank Bethany, everybody. I can finally see the comments here. Stacey, I'm so glad you like The Kiss Thief. And Katie is watching The Proposal tonight, apparently. So we'll hear from you, Katie. That's awesome. That is super cool. Now, what else did we have to chat about here? There's so many other things we can mention.
Well, someone had asked, I think, was your second novel easier, harder, more fun, more work? How did you handle being a second-time author? How did that differ?
Look, it certainly had its challenges, but my fervent prayer is that they each get easier as we go. It was definitely easier than Love and Other Mistakes.
It doesn't happen. No.
At least to a degree. agree. Love and Other Mistakes has got at least 6 different drafts to it, and that one took a long time, and I didn't know what I was doing, so the rewrites were really hard. And so that one was, I think people talk about editorial letters sometimes, you know, I think I saw someone say once that their normal editorial letter, which if you don't know what that is, you send your book to an editor, they send you back a letter that has like a half a page saying everything you did right, and then pages and pages and pages and pages of everything you did wrong. Uh-huh. And they were saying their normal ones were like 9 pages, and they got a really bad one that was 20. My editorial letter on Love and Other Mistakes, the very first time when I was working with a freelance editor before my contract, was 40 pages long. And it took me 6 months to work through all that feedback. And so, yes, this was easier than that. Thank goodness.
Wow, I'd say.
Because I learned a lot over the course of Love and Other Mistakes represented kind of a big me going from knowing nothing to being published. So
yeah,
there was a big learning curve in that one. Hallelujah, Girls Guide was easier than that. We only had about 3 drafts, I think. So, and I got some great advice from Rachel Houck and Susie May Warren. I started off with a totally different plot, a weird plot for this book. And I talked to them about it and they were like, that's like 2 different plots that you've tried to jam into one. You need to just pick one. That was the most best advice I could have heard. Thank you. They saved me like a year of going down the wrong rabbit trail trying to jam too much in.
Wow.
And so stuff like that saved me early on, thankfully. And then Rachel gave me some great advice after the first draft as well about Sam and Jules' relationship and how all that worked. And that really helped boost a lot of the Aussie stuff too. So thank you to the people who gave me good advice. And to my awesome editor Jocelyn for writing me a beautiful editorial letter that had lots more encouragement in it than my very first one. And although that first editor did a good job too, it was a rough book, I don't know. And yeah, and Jocelyn sent me one of the moments that became one of the, like, the beautiful ones in the book. There's a moment where Kimberly's like talking to Sam about his plans for the future, and because he's so kind of doesn't believe in himself as much as she believes in him, she's kind of trying to get him to see himself the way she sees him. And she says something about like, surely he had a dream, something he was afraid to hold up to the light. And that line is stolen straight from the editorial letter. Jocelyn sent me a beautiful little anecdote about her actual life in that when she was looking at that scene. And she was like, oh, Kimberly, you know, she boosted this aspect of Kimberly because that's really special. And so I just like took her thing and put it in there.
That's a good one.
So hopefully book 3 will be easier again. Let's fingers crossed, people.
Yeah. No comment. Do we have any other questions that have come in? Let's see.
I think Angela sent me through some more that I missed. Let me see. And Hannah had one too. Hannah mentioned, can I discuss the book and the Aussie fires? Obviously, I have a book about the outback. Australia's outback has been ablaze for the last several months. So thank you to all the people who messaged me. Not that there was like hundreds, it sounded like there's tons of people following me, but there was a couple of people who were like really nice. They reached out, saw my post about the fires, and they were like, are you guys okay, are your family okay? Thankfully all my family was fine. The fires didn't get too close to us, although one did get a bit close to my house while I was in the Middle East. That was a fun message to receive, but thankfully the water bombers put it out before it got too close. But yeah, so there has been like a lot of terrible fires in the outback and stuff, and it is a pretty realistic part of Australian life. We are known for our bushfires. We are not known for having them as bad as we had them this year. This has been ridiculous. But also kudos to emergency services for the amount of lives they saved. I saw a meme that they had up that wasn't just how many homes had been lost, but it was, or how many lives had been lost, but it was how many, then next to it was written how many they'd saved. There's thousands of people. They did an amazing job of keeping the toll as low as it was, although we did tragically lose Australian and American lives as well. Yeah, and even apart from bushfires, fire is, Australia's a hot country, it's a dry country, just in farms, and there's a lot of machinery around, and I can't say too much about what happens in the book, But I can say that fire's definitely been a real part of our lives. As I was a journalist when I was younger, and there's a picture I used about three different times of my brother's header burning to the ground. When he was 15, he bought a harvester and was harvesting my uncle's farm. And my mate Marty was driving the ferry bin behind him. And the thing about these machines, it's like a 30-year-old machine. They get very hot and they're very loud. So you can't hear anything else that's happening. And you sit very high. I'm not sure if the American ones have a different design, but in the Aussie ones, you sit. You need a ladder to go up and get up into them. And at one point, Jake saw Marty frantically waving from behind him. And he turned and looked, and there were flames coming up underneath him. His whole header was on fire. And he couldn't use the ladder. He had to jump over the flames and hit the ground and then run, because now the wheat crop's on fire, run through the paddocks, under the fence, through the channel to my grandparents' house and say, call everybody, everything's on fire.
Oh, my goodness.
And we're in a very flat area. The smoke rises. You can see it super easily. So everybody just came without even being called, with their water carts and their tractors and stuff. Half the Rural Fire Brigade are neighbours and stuff anyway. So they all came. Thankfully, the wind was going in the right direction, so it just burned onto itself. And it did burn the header to the ground, but the crop was fine. And my brother was fine. But my dad just got a phone call that Jake's header was on fire and didn't know how he was. So I won't tell you the speeds he reached on the back roads driving down to my grandparents' place that day. But and we also got a really good picture of it. So as a journalist, I put that on the front page. I put that on the magazine we edited the next month. I got really good mileage out of that story.
I bet.
Yes, fire is a real and constant threat, and thankfully my family's okay, and thankfully Australians and Americans have been incredibly generous with giving so much money to the Red Cross to help try and get people back on their feet. And if anyone's looking for places to donate, there are places like Drought Angels who give mental health support and hay and stuff to farmers especially, so they're good ones to look up.
Awesome. So, what is that called? Mm-hmm. You said Drought
Angels is Angels. One.
Okay.
Or if you can look up, I'm trying to remember what they're called, the Burrumbuddock Hay People. It's called Buy a Bale. Look up Buy a Bale Australia. That's what you call it.
Okay.
Burrumbuddock is like the name of the town, but it sounds funny, doesn't it? It sounds like it makes me laugh.
It does, but good cause, though. Okay.
Buy a Bale. You can help out some farmers there.
So, awesome.
Yeah, so that's good. Now, did we have any other questions here? Ooh, do I have examples of how you balanced making your book Australian but for an American audience?
Ooh.
Look, it is a constant challenge because, as you probably noticed from me talking and the podcast and stuff, Australians have different words or shortened words. I think we have like 4,700 shortened words in our vocabulary. I know it's the most of any culture. We have more shortened words than anywhere else. Read that in fact.
Wow.
Yeah. And so to try and make my Aussie, because three of the four main characters are Australian, I only have one American main character. And so many people are speaking Australian and they're from the bush, so they're going to use even more of those phrases and stuff because different Australian city and country Australia. So to try and keep their voices realistic and using the kind of phrases they would use and the kind of terminology they would use, but also not having to constantly explain terminology or leave my readers confused, there are a few times where I just sort of chose the easier word choice. So I just kind of tried to speckle it so it wasn't too intense, and then would have them either explain it to Kimberly or them kind of think to themselves, you know, track pants or sweats according to their American friend or something like that. And there were the occasional ones where I just put it in, just had to figure it out. I think at one point I referenced fireys, the firefighters, and it was a situation in which you're not going to stop and explain it. So I was like, I'm going to work it out. And everybody did. No one said, what does that mean?
Yeah, I was never once lost, you know.
Oh, that's good.
And what I loved about how you did all of that was, I mean, I loved the moments. I feel like you spread it out just right of having those moments where it had to be explained to Kim, because it made me feel like, oh, I'm a stupid American like her, you know? And so it was perfect. It was like, what's that? And sure enough, there was the explanation. So yeah, great job.
Oh, good. I'm glad, because I've had it in reverse. Which book was it? Dee Henderson had a book. It took me forever to realize what this meant. I plead the fifth. somebody said I plead the fifth in one of the O'Malley books. And I was like, what the heck does that mean? And it took me years to work out that it's like the Fifth Amendment or something very specifically American.
It's
the right to remain silent, isn't it? Which we all know about thanks to cop shows. We just didn't know it was the Fifth Amendment.
That's the Miranda rights. Those are different.
But they say you have the... We know there's a right of silence.
The Fifth Amendment is you don't have to testify. Like, they can't force you to say something.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's... And that's some... Yeah, I'm like, oh, yeah, that would make absolutely no sense if you did not know our Constitution. So
I remembered my frustration. I was like, I'm not going to do that to my readers. I got to make sure that we get enough things in there. I did, with great glee, write Sam's line about snags on the Barbie and that did not, in fact, mean a plastic doll, but was sausages on a barbecue.
Mm-hmm. Well, it worked out beautifully. I have more questions, but I don't want to get in the way of other questions. If people
hit me
have
with them.
Them.
I think the other questions are still rolling through.
Okay. I want to know what you did today to what you've been doing to celebrate launch, or what launch plans do you have?
Well, today actually coincides with my little sister who's sitting over there. She's smiling at me. Do you want to make your guest appearance, Abby? She's putting down her sandwich and coming over. It is my little sister's 12th birthday today. Very exciting.
Happy and birthday.
So we have celebrated her all day long.
Awesome.
So she's a great little advertiser of my book. She's very good at telling people about it. So, hey, everybody. Happy birthday to you, Abby.
Happy birthday.
So we went out and we had breakfast and it was delicious. But it was not for launch. It was for her.
Well, good.
Happy birthday, Abby.
Abby and Hannah are good mates. They know each other. We've stayed with Hannah. So apart from that, I'm doing this pretty much, and I don't have to work today. I took the day off work so I could see Abs on her birthday and do this, so that's my celebration. Now I've got to drive home and go back to work tomorrow.
Oh, let's see, I'm trying to see if anything else, if people have questions, you need to send them in
everybody. Let me just double check I haven't missed one, because I had some other topics here if we have finally run out of questions. Oh, the boxing too. We haven't mentioned the boxing.
Oh, we sure haven't.
I have mentioned this occasionally, but my agent was shocked the other day when I put up a post saying something about I'd done boxing training on and off for 10 years. And he was like, of all the things I did not expect to see on Facebook when I opened it this morning, that was something I really didn't expect. So I don't fight. I'm not good at it. But I have gone to just boxing class at a gym in town on and off for about 10 years in different places I've lived. And so you'll notice that there's little boxing scenes in both Love and Other Mistakes and A Girl's Guide. Mm-hmm. And they're not major because I don't know enough about it to make them major, but I can put in the little bits that I do know.
Just enough,
just enough. And so that was fun and cute. Now I'm going to have – I can't do it for a third book. I'm going to have to research some kind of sport. I avoid research as much as possible, but I'm going to have to branch out. It might be kickboxing. I'll just branch out a little bit.
Oh, well, it sure worked. Sure worked.
What else have I got here? Oh, some other real things in the book that came from real life. There is a character, just a little side character there named Bonesy. There is a real person named Bonesy, named it for slightly different reasons. He had no teeth and he would eat steak and he would just like gum it. And he was a neighbor that we had when I was a kid. And he was like skin and bones. So that was a fun little just. My mum read it and she was like, it's so weird reading this fictional book, but she kept like recognizing names or places or things that were real. So that was a fun little thing if you see Bonesy in there.
Yeah.
And Nip and Meg, some of the dog names, they are family dog names from my family. So, yes. You'll notice that there's a Nip. There's like a Nip 3 and 4. Because we had multiple nips.
You did that also. That's real. Excuse me. Well, I have to point out the book design is so amazing. How cute is that?
I love the kangaroos. They did such a good job.
They did such a great job. And of course, they're super, you know, the front is adorable as well. But yeah, when I saw those on the inside, I'm like, well done. Well done. Just that extra little detail that sets it over the top.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we've pretty much covered, unless there's any final questions that people want to shoot through, I think they've pretty much asked them all. Let me check. I had one little thing over here that had some questions from my Facebook group. Let me check that I've covered them. Rachel has a comment on here about they had edits that changed American spellings and stuff. Oh, American spelling. I actually find it not too hard to swap into American spelling. What I find hard is swapping back to Australian spelling when I go back to work, where they're like, it's not a Z, it's an S. It's hard. Now, here, Stacey asked me, she sent this through yesterday, why did you pick Australia as one of the countries? Because I'm lazy, Stacey, and it was easier than picking a different country. Because I live here, and I don't get to read that many romances, you know, that are Christian. There certainly are some, so go find them. There's great ones out there. There's a lot of great Aussie Christian authors, but there's bucket loads, and so, yeah, I wanted to represent some of my experience. Will I write other books set in Australia, also from Stacey? I hope so. So my publisher and I are chatting about it. We're going to see what we think the best plans are. But if people really like it being in Australia, then that makes it more likely. So tell us if you like the Aussie setting. And I've answered Hannah's question. Thank you, Hannah Curry, for sending in a question. She just got listed, speaking of great Australian romance authors, on the Inspi Awards long list. Hannah Curry's Heart of a Royal book. What was the cover design process like? Also from Stacey. Good thing to chat about. So they sent me this cover pretty much, and it was quite similar. I'm trying to think if I even made... I always suggest some different things to try just to see what it's like. And so we kind of fiddled with a few different things, but ended up, this was pretty much what they originally sent me, and we ended up just deciding that it worked. One thing we picked up on was the plane. So the plane there is on a happy, optimistic, upward trajectory. The original draft I showed to my workmates. Hannah's laughing because she knows. The original one, the plane did a couple of loop-de-loops, and then it pointed downward. And my workmate looked at it and he said, did they crash in the desert? And that's why she needs the guide to the outback, because the plane has crashed in the desert. I was like, no, where'd you get that from? He's like, well, the cover, look at it. They crashed. They're in a horrific plane crash. And so I emailed my publisher back and was like, so can we just point the nose of the plane upward? And they were like, oh, dang, yes, we can do that.
Good note. Good note.
And I changed Sam's sideburns. He had like long sideburns, and I just made them shorter. And that was pretty much it. I thought they nailed it. I think I wrote in my, you get to write like a little form that says what kind of things you want on the cover and what's important. And I can't remember if I wrote it or if I just thought if they send me the wrong one, then I'll make the point. But the hat was really important to me. Mm. Sam had to look like an Aussie farmer wearing an Aussie farmer's hat, and a Kubra is the brand name of our favorite hats, and not the cowboy ones that go up like you see at radios and stuff. Nailed it. This looks like my dad's hat. So I was super happy with that. And the little kangaroo on the spine, I can't show you because I've got the arc, which doesn't have the blue spine with the kangaroo on it, but Bethany has it. I love that. It's so cute. Little kangaroo. So happy yeah, about that. Gina asked me, is there a specific way you write dialogue so the Aussie accent comes through to readers? We talked about it a little bit before. We obviously the Australian phrases and words and stuff. But also, I think I shorten things occasionally, kind of the way Aussies do. And I don't know, for me, it's natural. So I'm just kind of writing how I would talk. And then it's more when I write the American characters, I have to try to actively strip that out and make it a little, try and make it a little more, not formal, but proper English and stuff like that is more the case. So I'm thinking about if I attempt a different American accent next time, but I'm a little worried because it's going to be hard.
Wow.
But anyway, we'll see. It's a lot easier for me to do the Aussie accents. And how did the idea for this book come to me? This one's from Megan. And what else am I working on? Oh, and she said she'll be bereft after she finishes the book. Well, to ease the pain, go read The Kiss Thief and that'll help like tide you over a little bit. So I can't announce anything about book ideas because we're still working out what that's going to be, but that's a fun process. So hopefully at some point I'll be able to tell you something about that. The idea for this book, it was probably helped a bit by Denise Hunter's Accidental Bride. Like that was kind of a story about them trying to keep the farm. And I think that I just wanted to do sort of an Aussie version of a story where a farm was at stake. And so I think I couldn't even swear to you that that's true because we're going back to like 2015 or 16-ish would have been when I started planning this story out. So it was a while ago, but yeah, can't really remember. Just wanted to do a story that showed my Aussie farm experience. So fighting to keep the farm, pretty accurate. So I think I'm going to check our comments here. I think we, Rachel says, look at the kangaroos. Yeah, she's a fan of the kangaroos. That's cool. I think that pretty much covers it. Do you have anything else you want to chat about, Bethany?
I mean, I don't feel like we had nearly enough Tom Hanks, but there will be other times.
That's true. And now I don't remember where we've done so many like false starts of us broadcasting for 10 minutes
before
we knew it wasn't working, where we talked about related rom-coms. And I don't know, we might be able to piece together different bits of recordings for the Story Nerds podcast. That's something we should say. This recording's going up on the Story Nerds podcast. So if you missed a part of it, you'll be able to check it out. It's going to be the first episode for 2020. We'll edit something together. And yeah, it's going to be good fun. Thank you so much for joining us, everybody. And thank you, Bethany. Thank you, Hannah, for sorting out the tech. Thank you, Angela Carlisle, future amazing suspense writer, for working on the comments for us. And everybody who's helped launch this book, I appreciate your efforts so much. And yay! Girls Get Out to the Outback. Yay. Out now in Australia and will be released in approximately, 4 hours in America? Like, it'll be the 28th?
Yep.
3 hours? Yep.
2 hours.
Two hours. It's going to be live in 2 hours. Awesome. Thank you so much, everybody.
Thanks for joining us for the launch party for A Girl's Guide to the Outback. Next episode, we will be back to our regular programming with special guest Carla Laureano to talk with us about coworker romances. Can't wait to see you there. Bye.